And I remember I just looked at him and I said, look, I had my dream job at 21 years old. I said, all of these things seem like I'm going backward. Who's willing to serve clients well? And who is comfortable in that uncomfortable spot to say, I don't actually know anything about this, but I'm confident in my ability to learn it.
You're listening to Leah Wiehalter, a CPA, CFE, and CEO of Workman Forensics. Welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
I wanted to learn more about their practice because if I can learn more about their practice or the problems that they're facing or whatever, then I can learn how to craft my message. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, you can say you're an expert in anything, but it's what people actually trust you to do and the problems that you're solving.
In this episode, we discuss why Leah started a forensic accounting practice, how she marketed herself to get clients, how her best practices became a book, and why customer service exceeds credentials. She is the CEO of Workman Forensics. She's also a podcast host of the Investigation Game podcast. She's a certified fraud examiner, CPA, and a private investigator. Leah Wiehalter, welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Leah. It's been a pleasure having you. Even though we are in the same industry and have maybe competing podcasts, it's always fun to have someone from the other side to talk about forensic accounting. And we met at the ACFE one time, I think.
That's right. We met at the global conference last year.
We did an escape room with a bunch of other people.
Yes. That was super fun.
Yes. You were like an expert in the whole thing, running around.
I do love escape rooms, and my husband and I own one now. So I think that means we're fully committed to escape rooms.
Well, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it. Why did you pursue an accounting career?
Because I wanted to be an FBI agent. Since I was about 12 years old, I wanted to be an investigator, and I was a very determined kid. And so I did all kinds of research in high school and decided that I knew I wanted to be an investigator. And then I chose the FBI based on all my research. And so when I moved to Tulsa from Texas and to attend Oral Roberts University. And so I actually chose my degree based on what the most likely hiring option would be for an agent from the FBI. And I originally, my freshman year, I started off with pre-law and thinking that I'd do the whole law school thing. And there was just too much reading. I needed more math. So some friends of mine were taking accounting, and I thought, I feel like I can do that. Like, that seems like my speed. So I took an accounting class, and I was right. So I switched over to accounting. But it was really, you know, a lot of my friends who were accounting majors were getting interviews with like EY or Deloitte or whatever, and interviewing for all of that stuff. And I just held strong. I'm like, no, I'm going to work for the Bureau. So that was the whole reason I became an accountant.
You and I have the same goals. When I was a teenager, I wanted to be an FBI agent. That's the reason why I got into accounting.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was one reasons why. And then my dad was also a CPA. So he was telling me that accounting is the language of business and you can go anywhere around the world and get a job. So I was like, oh, okay. And then I took accounting in high school and I was pretty decent at it. It was easy for me. So transitioning from accounting to high school, which is really just bookkeeping 101, right, into the freshman sophomore year of accounting, I had a knack for it. So I just stuck with it, you know. So, but that's what I wanted to do as well. Unfortunately, I didn't make it, or fortunately, I didn't make it. So it's all good. During college, you got an accounting degree. What happened after that?
I had an internship with the FBI between my junior and senior year in West Virginia. I was at the Criminal Justice Information Systems. That's where I was assigned. And so I was there for 10 weeks, had the opportunity to come back to Tulsa and work at the resident agency under a forensic accountant for the remainder of 2 years. So I ended up working on white collar cases primarily, and some other things too, but primarily white collar. And so I did that for 2 years, and then I went into public accounting. I took the first phase of the FBI agent test like the month after I turned 23, because you had to be 23 to take the test. I have no idea if that's still the rule, but so I took the test as soon as I could. And the FBI did not, it was like a personality and decision-making test. So I like to joke that the FBI didn't like my personality or decision-making skills when I was 23. I looked to work within the Bureau, and then I could I do that. But I was just really encouraged by my mentor at the Bureau and others. Yeah, I could stay with the Bureau. Maybe I looked at jobs at like Mexico City, Iraq, different places like that. But then they were like, hey, you've got this accounting degree. If you leave and do the accounting route, I bet you can come back as an agent once you have that experience. So that's what I decided to do. And I chose when you join public accounting, you kind of have one or two routes starting out, tax or audit.
Right.
And I chose tax because I thought, well, if I can prep my own tax return, that'll save me money in life. So I chose tax. And while I was there, we started getting inquiries for forensic accounting. I was there for about 3 months in public accounting, and it was a smaller firm. I think there might have been like 30 of us or something at this firm. They're much bigger now. But I remember we would have these like mentor meetings, and a partner sat in on one of them. And he said, you know, what would you like to do? And I said, I think that there's a market for this idea of forensic accounting. I had no data. I just thought I could see how the people would need this. And they said, okay. So then once they started getting inquiries, instead of referring them elsewhere, they let me and another CFE on staff kind of figure them out. And so I worked some really big cases for them for about 2.5 years and became a CFE during that time. Did not pass the CPA exam while I was there as much as they wanted me to. And then after 2.5 years, I started working with forensics.
So you actually were an employee at the Bureau for 2 years then?
Mm-hmm.
Like an analyst type of position?
It was a student trainee position. But I was the first person they'd ever had in that role. So I actually was doing analysis and stuff on cases by the time I left. And I testified before grand jury. And
were you going to college in that period of time, or just were you graduate already?
No, I was getting my master's, my MBA at the same time.
Okay. So you were a graduate from high school, from college at least, and you were a student trainee,
yeah,
even though you had a degree underneath your belt already.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Because my first year of my internship was my senior year getting my accounting degree, but I could keep the internship for 2 years. So I went ahead and went to grad school.
I'll share you a little small story. I interviewed with the Bureau too, and I was in my late 20s. Didn't get it for whatever reason. You don't qualify. Okay, fine. Secret Service, DEA, went through the whole realm and did the IRS one. The IRS picked me up. It was ironic because after about a year with the IRS, 6 months of training, right? And then a year later, 9/11 happened. So in, you know, September 11th happened, and terrorism was a huge deal. And so the Bureau was looking for all the accounting nerds, and they actually were putting IRS people on their JTTF, the Joint Terrorism Task Force. And I find it ironic, 2 years after they tell me that I sucked and then, you know, we don't want to hire you, they're now begging me to have an office space.
Right. Yeah, well.
And I was talking to the agent.
Sure,
I was talking to the agent beside of me, and I was sitting there. He's a, you know, FBI agent doing accounting and everything else. And I was just joking with him, going, you know, realize a couple years ago, I wasn't even worthy of even being in the school that you're in. But now, for some reason, you guys are sitting here asking me to, you know, to help do these financial investigations. And he just looked at me going, it doesn't make any sense either. Don't worry about it. I said, okay, all right. I mean, it's a good choice overall. I went to the IRS, but still, I thought it was kind of ironic. So you started a forensic accounting practice literally in the CPA's office that you were in at one time. And so what credentials did you get? You got your CPA and your CFE. Anything else?
While I was there, I got my CFE. Then I left after 2.5 years because I still had to prep taxes. And that was just a lot to work cases year round and then to have a busy season twice a year. It was a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
So I just left and started my practice. And in the state of Oklahoma, to investigate fraud, you have to be a licensed private investigator, CPA, or attorney. And I wasn't a CPA or an attorney, so I got my PI license. And so I ran and testified, or I ran Workman Forensics and even testified on behalf of clients as an expert as a PI CFE. In 2021, I had the opportunity to write my book, and I am crazy, I guess, but I thought, I know a whole lot about accounting. I've solved a lot of accounting things, but I don't have this CPA license. And so while writing my book and running a practice and working one of the largest cases of my career, I also sat for the CPA exam in 2021.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So that's a recent development, recent-ish. So I actually got my license early last year is when I completed that.
Give me the story of your being the forensic accountant slash tax return preparer for the CPA firm, and you decide to jump ship and start your own practice. What was the thought process behind all that?
I knew I needed to leave because just the stress was pretty crazy. So for various reasons. And so I went and talked to the headhunter that actually helped me find the public accounting job when I left the bureau. And he started showing me all these jobs, and it was like for controller type positions with really great businesses in town and probably would have made great money and all those things. And I remember I just looked at him and I said, look, I had my dream job at 21 years old.
Yeah.
I said, all of these things seem like I'm going backwards. I mean, like there's nothing about doing these jobs that interest me.
Mm-hmm.
But I was in the middle of dating my now husband at the time. I had no intention of leaving Tulsa, and I had all this really random experience. And there was nobody in town in Tulsa at the time who had a forensic accounting practice where they would actually hire people to work for them. Most of the forensic accountants in town were semi-retired professionals. So they weren't looking to build a practice in this space. And the headhunter said, why don't you just start your own business? So I called my mentor at the bureau and my mom, and both of them said, what's the worst that could happen? I was single at the time. I lived really, really cheap. And I said, well, the worst thing that would happen is I have to go get a job as a controller. So that's where it started. And I just started reading books and talking to people and just kind of figuring this thing out, because I had never planned to own my own business. I don't come from a family of entrepreneurs. So I just really had to kind of figure it out. But then at the same time, I was also having to figure out, what does forensic accounting look like in the private sector? Because that looks really different than it does at the bureau and working with law enforcement when you've got access to all this subpoena power and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I was having to figure out a lot of things. And also I've been a staff level and senior level in public accounting, but I had never done business development. So I didn't know people in town. My family doesn't live here. I'm not from here. It was quite the challenge to do that. And I had no money to do all of this. And so I really just had to figure it out.
You leave your CPA practice and you're starting your own thing. How did you get your clients for the first 6 months? What was your plan?
I gave a month's notice so that I could at least have like a paycheck, which anyway, that's a whole nother story. But so I gave a month's notice so I could kind of try to figure this out. The CPA firm told me I could take, there was one case that was ongoing that was big that just still might need some help. So they told me I could take that case. Then I had an individual say, hey, my kids like play soccer with this attorney's kids. I think this attorney would like you. Go meet with him. And I didn't know what I was doing. And I went, and I remember he agreed to a meeting. He was an attorney and also sat on the board of many banks. And so I went and I met him at one of the banks at the end of a board meeting and kind of pitched, this is what I think I can do for you. Which, by the way, I had no idea what I could do for them. I was just like, this seems like some stuff that I've read about, which there wasn't even, this was 2010. So there wasn't even as much content as we have now about forensic accounting or fraud investigation stuff. I went and I sat around this table with them and I left and I thought, oh my gosh, this guy hates me. The next day, he copied me on an email to one of his associates and said, hey, on this case, it was a partnership dispute within a family. And he said, on this particular case, I want you to use Leah as the forensic accountant. And that was pretty early on after leaving public accounting. And so I thought, oh my gosh, this is totally going to work. What I didn't realize was how long, you know, it was going to be until I actually had a paying client. So I had 3 months of just taking meetings like this. So if he, like this attorney then said, you know who you should meet is this other person. And so then I'd go meet that person. And then that person would say, oh, you should meet so-and-so. And so every time someone said, you should meet so-and-so, I would then email that person and say, so-and-so said I should meet you. And then I would go meet with that person. And I think one of the things that really worked for me as like, because I make that sound like, oh yeah, anybody would take meetings with me. No. I really have always focused, my MBA is in marketing. So I've always tried to focus on how can I serve this individual? Instead of saying, here's what I do and this is why I'm awesome and you should meet with me. Instead it was, hey, this person said I should meet with you, you know, and this is who I am. I would like to learn more about your practice. And so I would make it about that person.
Right.
And then I would go with questions. Typically, this is what would happen. I'd show up for this 5-10 minute meeting to learn about their practice, and they would end up asking me questions the whole time. But then I also had some where they took me at my word, which I was absolutely serious. I wanted to learn more about their practice, because if I can learn more about their practice or the problems that they're facing or whatever, then I can learn how to craft my message to help them.
Right.
This became a data gathering thing for me for 3 months. And then I just had to take odd jobs and pay my bills. But I did that for 3 months. And then at the end of 3 months, my very first paying case came in. I had been retained on other cases, but nothing I could actually bill against because I wasn't actually doing the work yet. But my first case that I got to actually bill for was 3 months after I opened. It was a $1.5 million embezzlement from a nonprofit. And I had to testify on that case. We had to turn around enough data for a temporary restraining order for an injunction hearing within, I think, like 10 to 14 days, something like that. That was my first time to testify outside of grand jury or tribal court. And like that was the first time I testified as the expert. That's what got me started. But it really required, I don't think it's just hustle, but hard work, for sure, diligence, but also reminding myself that even though I have a very real need to make money to pay bills, that the long game is to serve people well. And so that's what I was really focused on. How can I gather data from individuals about what they're needing? And then how can I serve them in the best way?
I'm just thinking here, you have an MBA, you have a bachelor's degree in accounting, and you have a CFE, and you're walking up to people saying, I can do your forensic accounting for you. A lot of times they want the CPA license or something above and beyond just a CFE. Do you find that to be true or not?
I think, again, it goes back to what I was just saying, just about serving people. Because here's the biggest compliment I ever got from the very first client that I met with that I thought he hated me. I later worked with him on a bunch of cases. But I remember one time he and I were driving about an hour and a half. He called me the day before and said, hey, I've got this divorce case. They're going to have somebody testify tomorrow. I need you to come and listen because we may have to put you on the stand too at the end of the day. Like, seriously, got hired the day before the hearing. And so we were driving out to the middle of nowhere, Oklahoma. I remember he said, because I thought it was crazy that he trusted me so early on and I didn't have my CPA license. And he said that the reason he gave me a chance was that he realized that I was aware that I didn't know everything. Because of that, he could trust that I wasn't just going to say things. I was going to make sure that I understood things and that I was looking for the facts and the answer, that I wasn't just going to pop off because I was confident in my licenses or my credentials or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that is what set me up in this field, even though I didn't have my CPA license till a couple of years ago or till last year, because not everybody on my team has all these licenses and credentials, because I'm looking for the same. Who's willing to serve clients well and who is comfortable in that uncomfortable spot to say, I don't actually know anything about this, but I'm confident in my ability to learn it, instead of just saying, well, I read somewhere, or not actually doing the work. And so I think that's how I was able to do these things. And in addition, because I had learned at the Bureau how to work with best evidence, work with data, and to work cases with the intention that it could later be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. When I'm working towards that level of work, then I don't have to sit on the stand and say, well, in my experience, when I started this, I was 26 years old. So I couldn't sit on the stand and say, in my experience, these
all,
things are fraudulent.
All 2 years of it. Yeah.
Right? Like, nobody was going to listen to that. So I had to rely on, I wanted to make sure that I was working from best evidence and data, because then I could sit on the stand and say, this is where I got this information. Here's a whole list of this information. This is how I know this. This is how I calculated this. And then somebody else, the other side, can sit on the stand and that's much older than me and say, oh, in my experience, blah, blah, blah. But I've just taken the facts and put them into the story. And then we've been extremely successful doing that. So I think all of those things have just built trust. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, you can say you're an expert in anything, but it's what people actually trust you to do and the problems that you're solving. The CPA, just for me, it didn't change my business. It just kind of completed what my personal goals and aspirations were.
I understand that there's a lot of forensic accountants out there, CPAs that stink. And there's a lot of non-CPAs that are very good. It's a different skill set altogether. They don't teach forensic accounting in CPA world. They really don't. It's financial statement analysis and auditing, maybe a little bit of tax, but forensic accounting is not really part of the test. But the general public does not know that. It's a very trustworthy credential where it has a level of trust. Oh, CPA. It's like saying I'm a doctor. Well, if you specialize in something, you're probably far better off. Not all CPAs do. Our CFOs, our tax preparers, our auditors, that type of thing.
There's a lot of different things to specialize in for sure.
When I see a CPA firm that says we're forensic accountants, I scratch my head and kind of laugh internally because I'm looking for the background. What did you do for 20, 30 years that made you this forensic accountant? Because unless you're doing this, in my opinion, consistently, you really can't be that good. And that's just me being biased. I just don't think that a CPA firm that does compilations, audits, tax returns, and oh, by the way, we do forensic accounting on the side, they're just not really that good. I don't think so. Because you're not doing that many interviews. I mean, there's a different skill. You have to have an investigator's mind, not just an auditor's mind. And I think it has a different skill set altogether, but that's just me. By all means, get the CPA license, but you can't show up with a CPA license and be good, is my point, I guess.
Yeah, well, and it doesn't mean that you're going to be successful at this work either just by having those credentials. My focus has been on how can I work more investigations than others, and how can I have experiences working cases that aren't just available to everyone. So there may be times when I take cases that I don't get paid on, or I don't get my full rate or whatever, but I'm going to do it for the experience. There's just some of those cases that I think are worth it, especially when you're starting out, that like I volunteered with the Tulsa Police Department for several years. So by volunteering there, I was able to work on some embezzlement cases for them, but I also learned more about how they operate,
right,
and what types of cases are good for them and you know, that they're willing to take. So then I can make those referrals for my clients. Sometimes we'll work pro bono cases just so that we can have that experience or give newer members experience, you know, on cases that there is no like 90-day deadline on type thing. I don't like to chase opportunities, but if I have the opportunity to work on something that only the big investigation firms work on, or that these types of cases don't come up very often and it's really specialized, you bet I'm going to do it. Because I want to work the things, because I can't tell you how many times somebody's called and I've realized, oh, that time that I just volunteered or helped somebody or served someone, that's actually setting me up for something bigger. And because no one can take that away, what I learned in that case by working that case and so forth.
No, I completely understand. You grow as a person and you'd be able to serve even better and more people with the experience behind you that you may not have had if you didn't take certain cases. Completely understand that.
Right. And you can't learn just by listening to a podcast or reading a book. Although those things are valuable, I just don't think that anything really replaces working an actual case.
I would agree 100%. It's kind of hard to go take a book and sit there and say, I'm a forensic accountant now. It just doesn't work that way.
Right.
And I've read a couple of forensic accounting books and I'm like, yeah, okay, it works, but got to have some war stories behind it.
Yeah.
All right. You wrote a book called Data Sleuth or Data Sleuth. What was the motivation behind writing this book?
Really, it was to communicate a process that my team and I had developed over the years. I've owned Workman Forensics for 12 years now, and I never thought I would be running a business. I really thought I'd be like a one-woman shop the rest of my life. So when we started getting the cases we were getting and I needed a team, I needed a way, you know, how do I give somebody experience? I was able to work all these cases at the bureau and then also in public accounting and then even on my own for a little bit by myself. But how do I give them that same type of training and experience? And I couldn't. And so I decided, like, you know, how do you catch somebody up on 5 years of experience? Like, you just can't, especially very focused and intense experience. I started working to create a process that would allow extremely brilliant team members to contribute their expertise to cases without expecting them to just run the whole case themselves. We had created this process that we were using internally, and I felt like we were being extremely successful on our side of cases, but I was getting frustrated with the opposing side, whether that was another expert or even law enforcement agencies, that just the way they were investigating cases, I don't think was using best evidence or any type of process or any type of quality control. And I thought, if this works so well for us, why don't I just share it with everybody? I think it only improves the industry. And so I wanted to put it on paper. And for us, it also became a training tool, because part of my training was telling people to go read these other books by other people, which is great. I still encourage that. But I thought that they're not learning my process from doing this. And so, you know, it became a training tool for my team, but also just helping other people who maybe want to get into this field or are already in this field, or even have that unique experience and they're trying to scale and looking at how am I going to teach other people to do this at the level that I'm doing this.
Yeah.
And so that's why I wanted to put it together.
So what's the biggest takeaway from the book? If someone got the book off the shelf, what was the biggest takeaway do you think they should get from reading this?
The power of the simplest kinds of data. So bank statements, credit card statements, payroll reports. A lot of times, especially if someone has been trained in public accounting, audit, even tax, they're just so naturally inclined to want to go to those financial statements, which is not best evidence, right? Like anybody can alter and change and all of that. And it's like trying to just interpret financial statements. That's not best evidence. The best evidence and the way that you can investigate things that actually result in some sort of solution is by using bank statements, credit card statements, and payroll reports. Not only is it the most reliable evidence, but also it's the simplest to communicate. So if you end up at a hearing, even if it's a bench trial or a hearing in front of a judge, or if it's in front of a jury, referring and relying on evidence that people are familiar with in their normal everyday lives goes a lot further than trying to explain why, you know, the significance of something in a financial statement. I can use accounting records to provide the story and to provide some context, but at the end of the day, the thing that I'm wanting to explain is really coming from this best evidence and really understanding what's in there.
And most of the time, your willfulness of them defrauding someone is because they changed the books and records from the bank statement and from the credit card statement.
So that can't be your best evidence.
One of the biggest takeaways I had from public accounting when I was doing that was clients would give you a shoebox of records and you had to just put it together, right? And for, what do? You go to the bank statements and you start inputting the records. That's kind of how you, you know, or to cancel checks back in the day. And you just input it in there and you start from the very beginning and built a financial statement out of that. And then when I went to IRS special agent training, they did the same thing what you're talking about, is it's always go back to the bank statements and take a look at it and input it and test and probe and see what's anomalies and outliers and what looks weird and, you know, that type of stuff. What's missing, what should be there, but not there. You know, that type of stuff. Yep. Mm-hmm. No, I would agree with you 100%. I tell everyone that I deal with, I need the bank statements and the credit card statements. But if you, it's even better if you can just download it straight from the website itself. And if you could put it in an Excel spreadsheet for me. Because I had to put an Excel spreadsheet anyways. Yeah. The CSV file. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
We'll go from there.
Yep.
So what is the most interesting case that you worked on in your career? Self-employed.
There's a lot. And they all have something just kind of strange about them. But the most recent one, what actually we finished in 2019, but because of COVID, it got delayed a little bit. So it's just now being wrapped up, not by us, by law enforcement. But it was a CEO of a company who colluded with the controller of the same company, and they didn't own the company, but he stole at least $7.5 million from this locally owned company. And it was in a different city than the owners. So the owners weren't like popping in every day or anything. And they trusted this guy to run it. There were benefits for him if the company did well. But I think this guy just decided he was going to take it early. You know, he wasn't going to wait on it to be profitable to get his share. So he, like I said, colluded with the controller to issue fake expense reimbursements to himself. And he would submit the expense reimbursement. And I mean, there's one on my chart that's for $200,000 even. I mean, we're not talking about 1,000 here, 1,000 there. I mean, the minimum was probably around 20 grand. I mean, it was crazy. And so he'd submit that expense reimbursement, and that would get input in by the controller into their payroll system. His real payroll would be deposited to his payroll account, you know, his like direct deposited to his account. But these expense reimbursements would be issued in the form of checks from the payroll company, and it would be FedExed to him at the office. He'd give that to his assistant. His assistant would go deposit that to a special account at a local bank. So that money was then used to make political contributions, charitable donations. He would take cash out of the bank every so often. He'd have his assistant go pull out $1,000, $2,000 in crisp $100 bills. That was the direction. And crisp $100 bills, and so that he just had some like walking around money. And then he'd go out to eat at some of the fanciest restaurants, and then he would buy half the restaurant's meals. So he was able to gain like a lot of power and influence and things like that. So that was one of the methods, which of course, by issuing these expense reimbursements, that avoided any payroll taxes or any income taxes
right.
on those payments, which is pretty similar to what the executives in New York for one of Trump's company, one of Trump's companies, but that's what they were accused of doing. So, and I've seen it in several cases that we've worked by executives issuing part of their payroll as expense reimbursements, but his was in addition. He was making well over $200,000 a year in his salary. And so this was extra.
The collusion occurred. So what did this guy get out of it? The other person?
Not much, like a couple hundred thousand dollars. I think that there was maybe a relationship there. There were a lot of rumors about that relationship, or maybe what the CEO had on the controller, potentially that the controller was actually stealing first. That was another rumor out there, but not really sure, because what we quantified during the period of time we were looking at, this controller maybe got a couple hundred thousand dollars. It wasn't significant. But in addition, just these expense reimbursements alone totaled over $3 million over the period of time we were looking at.
How do they classify these expense reimbursements? As in like travel or something?
So on his paycheck, it was classified as an expense reimbursement, right? So, but then on the financials, it would be classified mostly to the balance sheet. This was a manufacturing company. And so it would actually go against, it ended up getting reclassified against work in progress. When I was asked to go out there and look, I interviewed several people on the accounting staff, and they said, "Do you know about our spreadsheet and the fake job?" I said, "No, I don't. Please tell me." And so they pulled up this spreadsheet and they said, "This job number has never been closed out. It's been open the whole time." So I start looking at it and I see that this job has about $7 million in it. And my client thought their loss was around $3 million based on stuff he'd seen. And I said, "I hate to tell you, but I actually think your loss is closer to seven based on this fake job." So the expense reimbursements were about $3.5 million of it. But the remainder came from just using the corporate credit card to buy suits, to pay for people's meals, operating account. So that made up the rest of it.
So the cash goes out the door and at the end of the day, it's applied to a work in progress inventory type of balance sheet item that just continues to grow until it gets caught. So you have an asset that doesn't really exist.
I think they knew. The CEO was also an accountant. So he knew the ratios that the owners were going to be looking at. And so it was very clear in the accounting records that whenever they were trying to keep cost of goods sold and in the expenses to certain
parameters. Levels. Yeah.
And so they would just reclass it to work in progress. The other thing that was interesting on this case was that since they are manufacturing, they had scrap metal. And so they would go and they would sell this scrap, and it would be like several million a year that they'd get back just from selling this scrap. They would also reclassify some of these fraudulent expenses and the expense reimbursements to scrap income. You know, there's not really a good way to track scrap income. You don't know what you're
sure.
You don't know what to expect every year, yeah. Right? So that kind of feels like one of those slush funds to me. Like that's extra money that nobody's looking at. They'd record the scrap income whenever they'd sell it, but then they would offset it with these fake expenses. So when we were in the scrap income account in the general ledger, this is getting a little technical, but when we were in the general ledger looking at scrap income, we could see how they had reclassed some of these fraudulent expenses over there, because it kept their cost of goods sold looking okay, and then it wasn't increasing their inventory too high.
It's just amazing. It's not really that complicated. The scheme is not really that complicated, where they're buying product and creating a fake company and buying a consulting fee, you know, or using it as a consulting type of deal. It's the scheme you're describing, and frankly, it's not really that complicated. You just have to know how to file some of the money and just kind of look in certain areas. It's interesting.
In this case, the loss was quantified by looking at my favorite things, your favorite things, bank statements, credit card statements, and payroll reports.
Yep.
And so we were able to classify all of those things. Then we were able to quantify, okay, these things don't appear to benefit the business. Then we could go look at the general ledger and see, oh, well, if this was actually an advertising expense, it should have stayed in advertising. But we can see where it was reclassed against GRAP income, or it was reclassed to WIP. And so then that gives us the story.
Makes you wonder who's behind the scenes cooking the books.
Right. It helps prove that this isn't just our opinion that didn't benefit the company. The people who were running the scheme did this to hide it.
Yep.
And so to me, the fraud equation that I talk about is fraud equals intent plus benefit. So the benefit we quantified from bank statements, credit card statements, payroll reports. The intent was in those transactions and even in the memos to say, this is against this special job or whatever. And that provided great evidence of intent.
If someone is interested in being Leah Wheatalter, what would you recommend?
Oh, gosh. I
want to be just like her when I grow up.
I don't think you should become Leah Wheatalter. I think you should become like the best version of yourself, first of all, but like whatever's in, you know, your heart to do. But I just think that some of the things that have worked really well for me is just being diligent, doing whatever I say I'm going to do, following through, meeting deadlines, and, you know, being honest with clients, like not just trying to meet a deadline to meet a deadline. But if we don't have the best results or the best evidence, or we just don't feel comfortable releasing something by the deadline, like we just tell people. So being honest, and then really just serving others and being generous in doing so. It's just provided a lot of opportunities that I can get the degree and I can get the credentials and the licenses and all that stuff. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I think it's the character that shines through in this line of work. And so being diligent, being generous, serving others, and being honest, it goes a long way.
What resources or training have helped you along your journey? We talked a little bit about your bureau background, and I guess you had a little bit of forensic accounting background, or at least started off on it with a small CPA firm. What else has helped you out there?
So I definitely recommend Global ACFE Conference. I think ACFE has great training resources, even online, things like that. But I think in addition to kind of those more traditional routes, really getting involved with investigative communities, whether that be on LinkedIn, which I think is actually how we met, getting connected with LinkedIn communities, following people, going to some of those, like just getting to know those people on LinkedIn has just provided additional training opportunities, but even local chapters of the ACFE, just to learn from other investigators. And like I said, I think working cases is what gives you the experience and the confidence to work more cases and bigger cases and all of that, and makes you better. So I knew that that was impossible first year into my career, or even third year into my career, whatever. And so I, even when I was at the bureau and afterwards, I just wanted to hear story after story, because if I could learn from other people's experiences, then whenever it showed up, you know, as a client call, oh, I remember my friend Dave talked about this payroll case he worked, and then just not being afraid to like ask for help. So I would call that person and say, hey, I've got a case that reminded me of yours. I'd even bring people in to consult, like they got paid for their time too on the case. But really just learning from other people, I think, is invaluable.
I have found that people like you and I are different even in the ACFE world, because most people are on the fraud prevention side, internal audit. They're not really in the, oh, it already happened, let's find out how it happened. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong here, but it seems like there's not many people that actually do the forensic accounting post it occurring. How's that? we have to figure out what happened. It's usually on the, based upon what I've seen with the ACFE, is a lot of prevention side of things. And when I talk to folks, a lot of it is, oh, I'm an internal auditor and I'm here to learn how to prevent the fraud, which is always the better way of doing it. I just didn't find that many people like you and I that walking around that were actually in the investigative stage that were hired to find it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think there are fewer jobs in what we do. And a lot of forensic accountants, I feel like, are kind of sole practitioners. They're not necessarily growing entire practices, although it exists. It exists with some of the larger investigation firms and some like Deloitte, PwC, things like that.
They're getting the multi-million dollar IBM, Chevrons, you know, that type of stuff.
So unless you're doing that or sole practitioner where you are, and it's just an interesting business too. I mean, it's very risky. I remember when I started my business and I showed up at the local chapter meeting after I was completely on my own, I just saw the looks in my friends' faces. They're like, how, because they were all semi-retired, and they're like, how are you going to do this? And I mean, I'm not going to lie, it was hard. Like, it was really hard. I don't really focus a lot on that. If somebody's thinking about doing this, like, you just need to be prepared for it to be a challenge for sure. But it's doable. But I do think that there's more jobs in the internal audit space or prevention space because of compliance and right, SOX and things like that.
Looking back on your career, you have a biggest mistake or lost opportunity?
Okay, biggest mistake. I'll tell myself, don't do this. Don't do this. I'll tell you this one thing. So I had a criminal defense case. It was in federal court. It was in another state. So we didn't have like an office where we could work on things. And I have never told this story. So we're in federal court. There was a piece of evidence that wasn't printed. So, and I think it was like during voir dire, like it wasn't, the jury hadn't been selected or anything. And so the, you know, the attorneys are asking questions of the jurors and things like that. And I remember there was this piece of paper that we didn't have printed for some reason. And the attorney had like put this printer I purchased like on the table, cause we're kind of having to work from the courtroom. And the client says, print it out, print it out. I'm like, I'm not going to print this out in federal court. Like, what are you talking about? He's like, print it out. We got to have it. We got to have it. And so I printed it. Then afterwards, of course, the clerk came up and said, like, you can't be printing in federal court. I'm like, I know. But anyway, probably one of my most embarrassing moments. But it did get us a like a witness prep room or whatever. They finally gave us a little room where we could go work. Because I mean, I just told him, I was like, we're going to have to print stuff. So we either print here where we are or, you know, something, because we didn't have an office. But that was probably one of the most embarrassing stories. Don't print in federal court.
I could have told you that. I can see I can see you, you know, slapping this printer on top of the desk in front of the judge,
no, and
looking for the power source, having it hum, do all its checkup, and then all of a sudden press print, and you hear this.
I know.
And if anybody's been in federal courtrooms, it's a huge cavernous type of probably building where it's very ornate and it echoes all over the place.
Yeah. This wasn't that bad. This wasn't that bad. I was mad at myself that I let my client convince me to do that. Because, I mean, I've been in federal court plenty of times with the Bureau, and I was like, this is so dumb. I mean, he's right, though. We needed the piece of paper. He was right. We did.
Yeah, so, yeah. Go out in the hallway.
Anyway, the judge didn't hear it, but the clerk was like, you can't be doing that. Like, I know. So anyway, there you go. There's my... I know that's probably not what you were looking for, but that's what...
No, it's a funny story. All right, ready for the final four questions?
All right, yeah.
All right, here we go. Final four. What is your biggest motivation now?
Just how we can continue to expand our data sleuth process and make it more automated and available to more people.
How big do you want to go in your business?
Probably not much bigger than I am right now.
How many employees do you have now?
I have 3 employees. We get a lot of work done. I like being small and efficient.
I understand. After a while, it starts becoming an issue where... Do you want to build it so you can sell it, or do you want to just build it and just kind of just enjoy it? What book or books have changed your life or thinking?
Ultimate Sales Machine. I didn't even make it through the whole book, full confession, because I got to this chapter about how to hold workshops with your teams. And he was talking about sales teams, but now we do this on every, we use that same workshop model you know, I've adjusted it and whatever. But we use that same model for case planning. We use that for process improvement. We use that for just any type of like creativity when we're doing product development, things like that. That's one of my favorite books. And building a story brand.
Who wrote Building the Story Brand?
Donald Miller.
Oh, yeah. You're the one that told me about his podcast, Business Made Simple.
Right.
So, yeah. Actually, yes. It's a very good podcast. I don't listen to all of it because some of it's like, I don't need to worry about, you know, how to build your sales team because I don't have a sales team. His podcast, Business Made Simple, is very good. There's some practical tips to it. I've actually used a couple of his recommendations at the end of his podcast. Highly recommend it. Share something that you've purchased in the last 12 months, less than $100, that you've enjoyed or made your job easier. It's good enough for Leah. It's good enough for the whole world. What would that be?
Yes. I found a really sweet bomber jacket under $100 at a boutique in Branson. I do love that thing. It's like a rust color, and then it has like dark purple sleeves and collar. It's just cool.
Very nice. If you had to do something else, you get fired today, turn in your CPA license, turn in your PI license, you're no longer a CFE, what would you be doing?
I would probably just run escape rooms.
Why did I see that coming? I should have saw that coming. Yeah. How many escape rooms have you gone through so far?
I'm probably around 40.
Good heavens.
I got slowed down. Oh gosh, there are people who come to our escape room that have done anywhere from 200 to 400 escape rooms. So I am not even close to being that level of enthusiast. But I kind of got slowed down when we started building our own. So I haven't been to very many lately.
I've only done like two, I think. Something like that.
I think they're just so great.
Well, Leah, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I really do appreciate it. And best of luck to you with the Workman Forensics and your Investigation Game podcast. It's good having you.
Thank you so much.